Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
Welcome to Pod Save the World. This is Tommy Vitor in the studio with Ben Rhodes.
Ready to roll.
Great to have you, man. We have a packed show today. First, our friend Kelly Magsman will dial in to talk about Trump's designation to designate the Iranian Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. So you'll hear from her. She's an expert. Then we're going to talk about the Israeli elections, Chinese spies trying to infiltrate Mar-a-Lago, personnel issues, the President Sisi visits the Oval Office from Egypt, and then, you know, Sudan and some of the Arab Spring 2.0 like things we're seeing across Northern Africa, and then Brexit. After that, you'll hear an interview I taped last week with an author named Patrick Radden Keefe. He has an incredible, incredible new book out called Say Nothing. It's about the IRA and the troubles in Northern Ireland. It's one of the best books I've ever read, and it also is really relevant today because Brexit could reignite the troubles and the conflict that really destroyed Northern Ireland for a long time. So, pack show, and let's get into it. Okay, the first news item today has to do with Iran. So Ben and I decided to get our favorite Iran expert on the line. Kelly Magsman, it's great to have you.
Good to be here, guys.
So on Monday, Trump designated the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, as a foreign terrorist organization. It's an interesting timing to do this the day before the Israeli elections.
Yeah, what a coincidence,
what
Tommy.
What a coincidence, Kelly.
I guess that policy process just really landed right the day before.
That was amazing how things work out. So, Mags, the IRGC is an arm of the Iranian military, carries out operations across the Middle East, and is led by some very bad people. You're an Iran expert. You've worked for Republicans. You've worked for Democrats. I imagine a lot of people have debated this move previously. Can you tell us like what the IRGC is and what this designation means and if you think it's a good idea?
Sure. I mean, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, for folks who don't follow Iran every day, is pretty much basically kind of the elite army and navy and forces of the Iranian regime. It's about 125,000 or so is estimates. It could be larger. But these guys, these are good guys. In fact, as you know from our time in the Obama administration, these are a bunch of goons. These aren't good dudes. And they're pretty well tied into the Iranian economy as well. So they run a bunch of front companies for the Iranian regime and make a lot of money. So these are, you know, their sole purpose is to protect the ideals of the revolution, but they're also a deeply corrupt organization within Iran. So they're not great guys. In terms of the move yesterday, you know, from my perspective, it doesn't really do anything materially different. I mean, we have sanctioned these guys under previous sanctions authorities in both the Bush and Obama administrations, both under for counterterrorism reasons as well as for counterproliferation reasons. So this new designation actually will have no real material effect, I think, in terms of putting additional pressure, economic pressure on the Iranian regime. It's really, from my perspective, a largely symbolic move right now. And of course, as you mentioned, it happened right before the elections in Israel. And it's pretty much a gift to Bibi Netanyahu from Donald Trump. So yeah. I think it's mostly a symbolic move. Now, that said, I do think that it imposes a bunch of risks on us that were frankly unnecessary. So, for example, you know, U.S. forces in the region could now potentially be targeted by the IRGC in retaliation for this decision. So that, you know, potentially puts our forces at risk. This was against the advice of the Secretary of Defense and some of the members and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the cabinet who were worried about this issue. And it also kind of puts some of our allies in a tough spot, especially our Iraqi friends who are working really hard to stabilize Iraq. And this could potentially be destabilizing for the Iraqis. So in some ways, it's a symbolic move that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, other than just being a rhetorical win for the president.
Yeah. So, Kelly, I mean, the Trump administration, they obsess with Iran. in such a weird, disproportionate way that I feel like I'm constantly in this odd position of sounding like I'm defending Iran, even though I'm not. The IRGC, as you said, is horrible. They do terrible things. Notably, the Pentagon estimates that one in every six combat fatalities in Iraq were attributable to proxy forces that were sponsored by the IRGC. So that is a very notable fact. But I mean, I guess the question I have for you guys is, do we think that a move like this helps or harms the IRGC's standing within the broader political system?
I mean, I think it's if the goal of the administration at this point is to put additional economic pressure on the regime or to somehow try to fracture the regime or potentially do regime change, which we all think is a bad idea, I think this is actually a potentially counterproductive move because it's going to solidify support for the hardliners within Iran, especially within the IRGC. Because frankly, if there was going to be any regime change in Iran, you know, there are going to be elements of the security forces that would be in play. But I think this actually potentially solidifies them around,
what do you
around
think,
the regime.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Kelly completely. The two things I'd say are, one, you know, if there's some kind of unwinding, unraveling in Iran, perhaps because of the economic pressure, some of the internal pressures, actually the most likely force to emerge from that is Qasem Soleimani, is the IRGC. They've got it pretty well wired there. They've lived under sanctions, as Kelly said. It's not like these guys haven't been sanctioned. They've been sanctioned as an entity. They've been, as individuals, sanctioned. So it's not like they've just lost a bunch of freedom of movement or freedom of action that they had. So they will also know how to play the game of essentially using this to try to pull Iranian politics in a harder line. And the second point that concerns me about this designation is, I don't know what you think, Kelly, but the only rationale I can see behind the direction the administration has gone is they're trying to goad Iran almost into a conflict. That's what this feels like to me. It's like they're going to squeeze and push and push and push every button that they can. They want Iran to stop complying with the nuclear deal. Keep in mind, Iran has thus far continued to comply with the JCPOA. It's almost like they're looking to try to push the Iranians so far in a corner that they then lash out and do something like pull out the Iran deal or launch some attack against our forces that can spiral very quickly into conflict, right? So my concerns are double. It's both, what does this do inside of Iran? You saw Rouhani come out. You know, they designated CENTCOM as a terrorist organization yesterday in a kind of whataboutism tit-for-tat. That's not the normal orientation of the Iranian political leadership. That's a reflection that the Iranian political leadership has to circle their wagons in their system. I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that's how their system operates, that if this kind of shot is taken at them, everybody rallies behind the flag, and that strengthens the IRGC. So that concerns me. And then the other thing, again, that concerns me is that the administration is just trying to press every button they can to get an escalation.
Yeah, I totally agree with Ben. I mean, I think, you know, from my perspective, it's not really this move that's necessarily concerning. It's the cumulative effect of all of the decisions that the administration is making. And what's weird to me is that I don't really know that Donald Trump is like itching to go to war with Iran. I'm not sure that it's a winning issue for his base. And so he's surrounded by a bunch of people who are, like, as you said, obsessed, right, with this issue. And so I don't think even he realizes, maybe I'm giving him too much credit for being stupid, but, you know, that the cumulative effect of this could potentially be backing us into a situation where we do end up in a conflict with the Iranians. I just don't know how much of that the president himself is actually conscious of.
Man, do you guys think there will be a point where European allies or others start criticizing us for seemingly going after the Iranian regime too hard?
You know, I was just in Europe, and you get a sense there, just this overwhelming frustration with us, that we put them in this horrible position where we brought them along for 7 years with sanctions and diplomacy to get the Iran deal. The American government under Barack Obama did that. Now the American government has put their companies in this difficult position where they are having trouble doing business in Iran or have to pull out of Iran. Their European governments are trying to keep this deal alive, and they see Trump and his administration ratcheting this up. You know, I agree with Kelly that what worries me is, like, Trump probably just cares about the politics of this, right? You know, doing this favor for Bibi or telling his own audiences here how hard line he is and how tough he's being on the Iranians and how he's going further than Obama. But Bolton and Pompeo, I think those guys would be, you know, perfectly okay with a war.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a year and a half is a long time. They're moving pretty fast. To Kelly's point, this cumulative steps, are accelerating, and a year and a half is a long time. And as we talked about before, there's a lot of ways that a conflict can escalate with Iran. I think another point that's worth making here is I don't give a dime's worth of value to the bullshit that they spew about supporting the Iranian people and democracy in Iran. We had Jason Rezaian in here. You have Iranian Americans in here. You have Iranians that you talk to who want Iran to reform, who want to move away from being kind of a terrorist sponsoring state, who want better relations with the West. They will consistently tell you, unless they're like the weird MEK guys who pay Rudy Giuliani to speak at their conferences about overthrowing the government in Europe, they will consistently tell you, you want to help the Iranian people? Get rid of the fucking travel ban and let Iranian middle-class people come study in the United States, you know?
Even right-wing hawks will say that.
Yeah, like Mark Dubowitz said this is insane. There's no consistency to their rhetoric. And so it makes this rhetoric about helping the Iranian people. We're hurting them with sanctions. We're hurting them with the travel ban. We're empowering the worst actors in Iran by embracing this frame of escalation, we're setting back the cause of democracy in Iran.
Yeah. I mean, I think this administration, it's very clear that, you know, Pompeo and Bolton, you know, have decided that they're going to do regime change through economic pressure and that that's going to be how, you know, they change the regime. I just think they have no sense of what comes afterwards. It's not like it's going to be an easy, you know, transition if it ever did happen. I don't even know if it would work. But it's clear to me that they're just throwing all of the eggs, you know, against the wall or whatever, bad metaphor. But, you know, and just seeing what happens.
No, that's actually the right one.
That's the right metaphor, Kelly.
It's not a basket. They're just fucking throwing them against the I can picture John Bolton sitting there just like hurling eggs against the wall.
I know. Anyway, it's Easter, right?
Almost. Yes, that's right.
So yeah, I mean, I think it's just there's no – I don't get the sense they've actually thought through the second and third and fourth steps and what comes afterwards. And it reminds me a lot about Iraq. I mean, you know, leading ourselves into a situation where we had no idea what the outcome would be, you know, once there was regime change in Iraq. And look where we are now. So I think there's a lot of deja vu for me in this situation.
Agreed. Well, we will watch this closely. And Kelly, thank you so much for joining, because literally no one has taught me more about Iran than you have. So thank you for that.
I like having the Goon Squad reunited.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. There we go.
Personally.
All right, buddy. Thanks again. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye, Kelly.
Bye.
Support for Pod Save the World comes from the International Rescue Committee. The IRC works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, displaced families are experiencing war, extreme hunger, and life-threatening injuries. In Gaza, ongoing violence, bombardment, and blockade have made survival difficult for families living in damaged buildings and tents. The lack of safe water, medicine, and healthy food contributes to the spread of diseases, and children are especially at risk. The International Rescue Committee is working with local partners in Gaza to provide life-saving medical care to injured civilians. The IRC works around the world to help families in crisis by delivering critical supplies such as therapeutic food for malnourished children, clean water, cash assistance, and more. Your donation will support this work and help children and families survive. Listen, the International Rescue Committee is an incredible organization. They are doing the Lord's work all around the globe. I have donated to them, you know, for many, many years now, because I know that my dollar will go towards helping people. It's not going to go to administrative costs or overhead fees. It's just an incredible group doing great work. I hope you'll consider them. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild. That's rescue.org/rebuild. Pod Save the World is brought to you by the UN Refugee Agency. The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations, and they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation. That's unrefugees.org/donation. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? My all out of conversation juice, love it. It's a famous love it line at a dinner where you just didn't feel like talking anymore.
I was coming down, shall we say, and a very famous person was talking to me, and I just looked them in the eyes and said, I'm out of conversation juice.
It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially when social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/crookedworld. Go today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/crookedworld. All right, Ben, the Israelis went to the polls today, and we will soon know whether our best friend, Bibi Netanyahu, is still in charge of Israel. But, of course, no Israeli election would be complete without a bunch of super fucked up, desperate 11th hour haymakers. So the first one was Netanyahu announcing that he plans to annex settlements in the West Bank. No huge surprise there. His entire party supports that position, but no Israeli prime minister has done that yet. But the Likud party also, it was reported today, apparently hired 1,200 people to secretly film Arab voters in polling locations. So that is deeply racist. As we were recording this, we don't know Bibi's fate yet, but there is a chance that win or lose, he just killed off any hope of a two-state solution. So thanks for that, Bibi. What do you make of this election, Ben? What are you looking for?
Well, I think people have to recognize, you know, it's always kind of strange for me to see, like, he'll come out and say he's going to annex the West Bank, and people act like, oh my God, they're shocked. Like, this is what the guy's been doing for 10 years. Mm-hmm. The settlements they've been building have been a de facto annexation. He's already said there won't be a two-state solution on his watch. The Golan Heights annexation clearly foreshadowed what they could do in the West Bank. So I'm getting a little tired, frankly, of people, you know, in the media or in politics being like, wow, you know, shocking move by Bibi. Like, no, they've been telegraphing this for a long time. It's not only the death knell to this two-state solution, but it's really the transition of Israel potentially into being an apartheid state. We just say it. I mean, what else is it, when you have millions of Palestinians living there without any rights? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Right. I know this is super controversial language, but please tell me what it is if you have millions of people living in your within your borders who have no status, who can't vote. You know, we have to start talking about that reality, because that's where this is going. On the filming Arabs voting, again, it's like here in the U.S. where, and again, to be fair, that I'm not singling Israel out. We've seen these anti-democratic practices around voting and around national identity in a bunch of Western countries. But, like, again, let's kind of not sugarcoat this. I often talk, you know, the standard talking points about the U.S.'s relationship are about our shared democratic values. Like, are those part of our shared values? Like, I'd like the next politician who, you know, stands up at AIPAC and gives an homage to the shared democratic values to be asked, well, when a bunch of thugs go around, you know, trying to intimidate Arabs by videotaping them as they vote, like, is that what part of the democratic values is that phenomenon?
It's not particularly democratic. Yeah, I mean, so Bibi is very good at solving a near-term problem for himself,
political problem,
in this case, to get elected potentially, and creating a much larger long-term problem. So if they just annex all of these settlements, if they essentially take control over the whole West Bank, that would mean, what, 2.8 million Palestinians are now part of a greater Israel. You'd have a one-state solution. Now, the question then becomes, do they have voting rights? Are they allowed to participate in politics? And then you get to the point that you made earlier, which is, how is that a democracy?
No, and this is just uncomfortable, but, like, because it's 2.8 million Palestinians on top of the Arabs who already live in Israel,
right,
who've been somewhat downgraded in recent years.
Right, by the nation state law.
Yeah, and so people have been trying to point this out for a long time. I remember Obama giving a big speech about this at AIPAC, intentionally went to AIPAC, saying you cannot have a Jewish state and a democracy without a two-state solution. Because if it's a Jewish state in which Arabs are second-class citizens, that's not going to be a democracy. If you have a one-state solution that is a democracy, it's not going to be necessarily Jewish in character, because you could actually have a Palestinian majority in those borders. This is a conundrum. Now, BB's whole plan all along, you know, we've always said, and I've thought, like, he wants to get the next election. He makes his alliance to political convenience. But maybe this was the goal. I mean, maybe actually the method was that he wants to annex the West Bank, and he's on the precipice of doing that. And with the U.S. administration that will back him in anything he wants to do, you could see that. What we don't know is, what will the Palestinians do? How would they react? Mass nonviolent resistance? Is there a danger of another intifada? You know, there are other actors here other than Bibi and Trump, and it could be a very volatile situation. But I do think, as we've talked about, you know, exhaustively on this pod, but importantly, people can't, like, kind of hide under the table on this issue anymore. You know, like, they can't just say, well, I'm for a two-state solution, but we can't pressure Israel, and we share democratic values. Well, we don't share values with a country that would have 2.8 million people who've been under military occupation and absorbed and denied any rights in that country. And so we need to be having a conversation now about what it means if that's where this is going.
Yeah. Interestingly, Pete Buttigieg came out and criticized Netanyahu's announcement about annexing the settlements. Beto O'Rourke referred to some of Netanyahu's comments as racist. So I was
hard
for
that, but then I saw some people being like, "Whoa, wow, Beto said, what is he if he's not racist? Like, this is the same problem we go with here with Trump. Like, this is a man who trashes Arabs repeatedly, who backs settlers who commit acts of violence against Arabs, who's got people on his behest out videotaping people voting, and people saying, Beto, you know, wow. What would you call that?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
what's the polite way of identifying that?
Feels pretty clear cut. So we're sitting here. I think polls have closed. We don't know the outcome. Gantz has been running a pretty strong campaign as an alternative to the Bibi Netanyahu. And the way the Israeli political system works is it's wildly complicated proportional representation. So you have, like, I think 40 parties are running. They each would need to hit a 3.25% vote share to get representation in the Knesset. After that, the parties have to build a coalition so that they can form a government. It's complicated. So we'll know more next week. But, you know, tough way to close out the election, guys.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, like, we don't know yet, but you know, Bibi tends to find ways to eke this thing out. And
always
cobble together his coalition. And even if Benny Gantz kind of matches him in vote total, like, Bibi's a survivor for a reason. And it's always because he moves to the right. And I'm not sitting here with a lot of optimism.
Yeah, me either.
But I would be happy to be surprised.
I would be too. Yeah. So, okay, turning to spies in Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah.
So on March 30th, a Chinese woman was arrested trying to get into Mar-a-Lago. She said she wanted to use the pool. She was carrying 4 cell phones, a bunch of hard drives, including some loaded with spyware. So, you know, standard pool stuff. You have the blow up donut or whatever in your spyware. It turns out that when investigators went to her hotel room, there's even more gear, including a device that detects hidden cameras with radio waves. That's pretty cool. 9 USB drives and 5 SIM cards. I guess a Secret Service agent put one of those USB sticks into his laptop. That's not the best practice there, just everybody listening. So, Ben, like, this person is clearly a foreign spy. Foreign governments are going to run spies at us. That's not Trump's fault. That's going to always happen. But we never really talk about the fact that the president of the United States spends, like, every weekend at a club where any asshole with 200 grand can be a member. It is, like, such an obvious, reliable, glaring intelligence target. Like, compare Mar-a-Lago to how hardened the White House is, or Camp David.
Well, this is why they built,
it's crazy.
This is what I say. This is why they built Camp David, right? I mean, the whole fucking reason to build this retreat deep in the desert, or not desert, deep in the woods of Maryland, is so you can go someplace that would be totally secure and private, right? And you've got this club who, nearest I can tell, has a membership that's a bunch of trashy rich people, grifters, like right-wing suck-ups, and foreign spies. Like, that's who's hanging out at the fucking pool at Mar-a-Lago, you know? Like, I don't know, when I go on vacation, like, I'd like to be around some, you know, interesting, like-minded people. Generally not around a bunch of fucking, like, right-wing hucksters and foreign spies.
You don't want the editor of Newsmax to have dinner with you every night or whatever right-wing outlet?
Well, there were these pictures of Trump, like, having meetings about, like, North Korea in, like, the dining room, right?
That was my favorite.
There's all these, like, so these aging people with, like, cell phone cameras, like, you think they're not recording devices on some of those things, and you think they're not some foreign spies in there? So this is, insofar as people knowing what's going on with Donald Trump or penetrating our systems, this is a pretty blinking red light. Yeah, you know?
Like we caught the one spy dumb enough to carry seven USB sticks and ask where the pool is. Yeah. There's got to be 400 more that got
exactly.
through.
Exactly,
because the Secret Service isn't protecting the infrastructure there. That's not their job.
Yeah, and guess what? The Chinese aren't always sending people who are Chinese. You know, right. Like they probably have some right wing grifters on their payroll. And so, well, I don't know that for sure, but I'm just saying that they have other people that they can have do this. The important thing is, as much as we cover these issues in a news cycle way, if you stack this with the security clearance thing, right? Mm-hmm. So they're giving security clearances to people who have been deemed to be potential risks right. by our own government.
Very serious risks, you know, in some cases.
Yeah, they've got people hanging out at Mar-a-Lago. Who knows how compromised in the last 2 years our national security information has been? Like, God only knows, like, what penetrations there have been into systems or what secrets have been shared. That should really worry people.
Yeah, it really worries people. Another quick just note on personnel and best practices. So a reminder that we now have an acting Secretary of Defense. This week, Trump purged basically the entire leadership team at the Department of Homeland Security.
It's kind of like, scary.
Including the Secret Service Director. Right? I guess he just had to shit-can everybody down until he got to the person he wanted to make the acting head. So we also have an acting Secretary of the Interior, acting SBA Administrator, acting Chief of Staff. So I just want to note, like, there is a cost, especially in foreign policy world, to staffing the government that way. So like an acting SecDef is going to be treated differently by a foreign leader than your handpicked guy. A full-time chief of staff can recruit a better team to work for him or her. They are hamstringing themselves. And again, it's the thing we don't really talk about.
They're hamstringing themselves. And like you say, Secretary of Defense, who's acting, who's just some Boeing lobbyist, is not going to be taken seriously by other people around the world. He's just not. Nobody's going to think he speaks to the president. Nobody knows if he's going to be around. But importantly, Tommy, there might be a method to this. So Kelly referenced that the Defense Department was against the designation of the IRGC. We've known in a lot of these interagency debates, the Defense Department has been against what Trump wants to do because what Trump wants to do is usually stupid and they would potentially pay for it. And maybe they want a weak voice at the table because I can guarantee you that when they had the meeting on the IRGC designation and Bolton and Pompeo came into that meeting loaded for bear and the Secretary of Defense has to come make the case against it, and he's just some Boeing lobbyist instead of Jim Mattis.
Right.
That's a big change. So they may want not just Trump, but people like Bolton and Pompeo to kind of leave this hanging. I think that's hugely irresponsible, given that we've got thousands of troops at war in harm's way. We've got millions of people that work for the Pentagon. It shows a fundamental disregard for this military that Trump likes to wrap himself in.
Yeah. President of Egypt came to Washington today. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi showed up in the Oval Office as he's proposing some constitutional changes that would undercut the judiciary, expand military control over the government, and I guess that's probably Trump's wish list as well. Yeah. It has been 6 years since Sisi deposed Mohamed Morsi in a coup in the name of stability. Unfortunately, things have just gotten worse, not better.
Yeah.
It has not stopped him from locking up protesters, activists, including some American citizens who are in jail right now. Okay, Egypt's an important relationship. They have been, the cornerstone of critical diplomatic work over the years. It's an important military alliance. All that stipulated. Do you think Trump should have taken this meeting?
No. I mean, and you don't have to. And it's not like we have some urgent, pressing matter of business with Egypt. And frankly, I think we got it wrong. We should have called it a coup when he had a coup. Mm-hmm. But we also kind of iced the guy and put some limits on what we did with them. But all that said, I don't think you do this. It sends a message. I mean, not that there needed to be another message sent from Trump, but it sends a message that we just don't care about these issues. And I'll be honest, like, even if Sisi's somewhat, he's going to be around, you can still make a difference, at least around the margins, in getting certain people out of prison or getting the worst laws rolled back. Like, there is such a thing as unsatisfactory, but still relevant human rights progress by using some pressure. And it looks like they just don't care at all. And so he's for them to do this meeting as he's changing the constitution, as he's kind of increasing his iron fist rule of Egypt, it sends this kind of more chilling message, the same one we sent with Mohammed bin Salman, that not only do we not have concerns about this, we're actively validating this repression. And again, in addition to just how bad that is for activists and democracy supporters around the world, it makes us look completely full of shit in Venezuela and Cuba when these only two countries in the world where we care about, or we say we care about these issues, who's going to believe that when he's sitting there with Sisi giving him a foot rub?
It also just reminds me that every time a democratically elected leader comes to town, whether it's or Theresa May or whether Trump goes to Europe or whether it's Macron or Justin Trudeau, it results in some pissing match.
Yeah.
Every time some authoritarian strongman like Sisi comes, it's all love in the Oval Office.
Just think about that, like how backwards that is.
So weird.
Yeah.
Well, don't like it.
I don't like it. It makes me sad.
So, Ben, let's go to Sudan for a minute. So there have been protesters holding sit-ins for several nights in a row to call for the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir. A reminder that Bashir is just a world-class asshole. He's the first sitting president to be indicted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide in Darfur. So last night, security services reportedly fired live ammunition to break up the protests. There were some other reports that more rank-and-file military members were protecting them. So that was an interesting dynamic. But what's happening in Sudan does seem to dovetail with our conversation last week about protests in Algeria calling for President Bouteflika's resignation. They seem materially different than what's happening in Libya, where there's a warlord fighting the UN-backed government. I'm just curious if you had thoughts on what you're seeing in Sudan or Libya.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, in Sudan, it is pent-up frustration with an awful, corrupt, repressive government. Somewhat similar to Algeria, the circumstances are a little different in that Algeria was prompted by this election and the weakened of Bernie's nature of the leader. But there are commonalities there. In Libya, what we have is essentially the factionalism there that has been grinding away for years is coming to a boil, where you have this strongman, Haftar, who's kind of controlled eastern Libya and Benghazi. He's kind of backed by Sisi and the Gulf states and kind of trying to root out some of the Islamists in Benghazi. And he's essentially invading Tripoli and see over the objections of the United States government, by the way. Trump probably hasn't figured out yet that his friends are all backing Haftar, but over the United Nations and Europe. I think what it does say, though, to Sisi, particularly Sudan and Algeria, again, Sisi looks pretty good. He looks pretty entrenched. So did Bouteflika 2 years ago. So did Bashir couple years ago. These things can boil over. If you are corrupt and you are authoritarian, even though right now, in this moment today, that the trendy thing to say is, oh, the strongman is ascendant, you know, Bolsonaro and Trump and Duterte and Putin, blah, blah, blah. You know, the pot, you know, takes a while to boil over. And I think it's a message to us, and frankly, hopefully a message to activists around the world, that things can change very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so Sisi, whether or not he's still there 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you know, I think is an open question, particularly if he keeps this restrictive rule in place.
So this conversation feels familiar. It could be 2011, 12, 13, and the initial Arab Spring. You know, obviously, the response then was all-consuming, right? Yeah. I mean, was it 16 days of protests in Egypt before they finally forced the resignation of Mubarak? You know, it was an all-consuming thing for the White House. President Obama was constantly going out and giving speeches about you know, universal values and backing the protesters. Knowing what you know now, and you see these protests in Sudan and Algeria, and to a weirder extent Libya, do you think there's a role for the U.S. to play in terms of how we're talking about this or supporting people, you know, looking for a better life through protests and democracy?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's interesting is part of the reason why there was such an interest in, you know, what we were going to say, what Obama was going to say, really, in 2011, is that that was new, right? That, mm-hmm. you know, now people are kind of numb to this. But also because people just assumed that Obama gave a shit, right?
Very good point.
And this is actually an important point. Like, nobody thinks that Trump cares about these protesters.
No.
So nobody even, like, let's say they had a press briefing in the White House, which they don't. Nobody would, I think, even ask, because, like, nobody thinks that they care, right? And I think that's sad. Right. I think the American president, uniquely in the world, has been a figure that gives voice to imperfectly and hypocritically at times. But if we're not speaking up for human rights, if we're not speaking up for democratic change, there's not many other voices out there. I mean, maybe occasionally a European leader. So I do think there's a role to speak out. I think speaking out, you know, with humility is important. in a way that, that recognizes that we can't dictate outcomes and we can't control what happens. But I think, you know, being on the side in terms of the things we say of people who are at least trying to bring about change, and it could be even more incremental change, is important. I also think, frankly, we need to consider in this day and age, how do we have a set of policies that is able in the long term to support civil society and support the development, you know, better discourse within and between countries. You know, the old toolbook used to be that we funded opposition parties.
Right.
And as much as I can see why, the autocrats have kind of figured out that strategy and they just shut down those parties and cut off that funding. I think you might want to look at, well, because we should still be trying to support the development of civil society, hopefully by working with governments to invest in institution building. But if not, like maybe regional approaches where we're connecting activists from, you know, at kind of hubs in different parts of a region so they can share strategies. We want to support people who aren't even political, but maybe entrepreneurs who are change makers in society. We want to support women's rights and participation in politics. You know, we should be trying to find new ways not to overthrow governments, but to empower people. Not so much to bring about these moments, only the people in the countries can, but to create a better basis that when these moments happen, you know what they're doing.
Right.
You know, people have institutions that they can channel their energies through, or people have a discourse that has already been more open. So there's the short game where I do think you have to speak out for these things. And the longer game is I think we as a country need to think about how do we promote and advance democracy in different ways, frankly, than we have in the post-Cold War years, because the autocrats figured out how to stamp out those ways.
Yeah. Turn to Europe for 1 minute. So the UK Parliament passed a bill that prevents a no deal or a hard Brexit, I believe.
Yeah.
So that means they can't leave the European Union without all the details ironed out. It means the people won't feel screwed. There won't be runs on medicine. The Parliament then approved Prime Minister May's decision to see an extension, right? So it looks like they punted this thing down the road again. There's a whole bunch of wrangling happening at the EU about Brexit. So I'm never again going to ask you what's going to happen. And my only question today is, do we have a sense of when these guys might figure it all the hell out?
No, but I think one of the things that will be interesting to watch, so the one new point I'd make from our discussions about this in the past, the Brits cannot figure this out, and I don't see how they're going to. You know, they don't want a no-deal Brexit, but there's no Brexit that can get past Parliament. At a certain – so they're just punting and getting extensions, and I think at a certain point, the Europeans, the timeline question shifts out of the British Parliament and shifts to Europe. How long is Europe going to tolerate this uncertainty? For now, Europe is saying better to extend it and see if we can work something out because you know they don't want a no-deal Brexit. But at a certain point, I think this timeline question shifts to European politicians and whether you're going to get the 27 leaders of the EU to continue to give the British all this time and space that is being used to just argue with each other, I think that time could run out sooner than the Brits think.
Yeah.
So we'll go, obviously, a few more months here. But I think actually at a certain point, when the inability of Britain to do anything becomes clear, continues to be clear, that ultimately the final decision might actually be made by continental Europeans.
Speaking of Europeans, you were just in Berlin with Obama.
Yes.
How was it? We learn anything cool? What are they up to over there?
I think what was cool about it, I mean, he saw Angela Merkel, who's still hanging on. And like, look, part of what she's trying to do is before she passes the baton, she's trying to manage this Brexit situation too. But the you know, we've talked here, they've got their far right problem. There are a couple interesting things that struck me though. One is we had all these activists and parliamentarians and politicians from across Europe come together for this meeting with Obama, and then I met with a bunch of them separately. And what I'm struck by is how similar the energy is to here, in that you do have this real renewed sense of activism from younger people who are just fed up and
That's
tired
cool.
of the political elite, and they're getting into politics themselves, and they're shaking things up. And I met everybody from like an amazing Afghan woman who's become a refugee advocate, has an organization, to, you know, an amazing young parliamentarian from Macron's party, a woman in Switzerland who's beating back far-right ballot initiatives almost, you know, single-handedly with her organization. Young people are really filling the space that need to be filled in European politics. And that was kind of inspiring. And I think it could be interesting over time, you know, world those out there, for like the American progressive movement that has been building to kind of build some contacts and ties across the Atlantic. Because frankly, as we talked about here, Bannon's doing that. The right wing is well networked across the Atlantic. And the second thing I notice is there's similar debates happening there. So in some of these countries, like we were in Germany, the number two party in the polls in Germany after Merkel's party is not the traditional center-left party, Social Democrats. It's the Greens. Hmm. I met this guy who's the leader of the Green Party in the Netherlands, you know, really remarkable, young, talented politician. They just picked up an historic number of seats. Some of that is the kind of left, center-left argument we're having the Democratic Party here. And some of that is just how much people care about issues like climate in Europe. So interestingly, you know, they're going through the very similar, very familiar process here where there's a much more energized left that is in the process of figuring out what it is and how they can both win elections and what they should stand for.
Well, that is a great hopeful note to end it on.
Yeah, I left more hopeful than I went, which not always the case.
Yeah, not always the case with this show either. But stick around, because when we come back, my interview with Patrick Radden Keefe
about his
new
book. Amazing book.
Say Nothing. I learned more about the troubles in the IRA and Northern Ireland's history than I knew previously in my life. So check it out.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
On the line is Patrick Radden Keefe. He's a New Yorker staff writer and the author of an incredible new book about a notorious murder in Northern Ireland, the IRA and its consequences. The book is called Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. Patrick, thank you for doing the show.
Thanks for having me.
So anyone who follows me on Twitter knows that I read your book in less than a week and I've been annoying about how much I like it. So truly, congratulations. It's like, it is an incredible piece of work. First question for you, who is Jean McConville and how did you learn about her story?
So Jean McConville was not a name I knew until about 5 years ago, five, 6 years ago. She was, but it's quite a well-known name in Northern Ireland. She was a woman who was a mother of 10 and a widow in Belfast in 1972. When one night she was in her apartment in a housing complex in West Belfast and a gang of masked intruders barged into the apartment and pulled her out, dragged her out with her kids clinging to her legs and told the kids, you know, we just need to take her away for a few hours, we'll bring her back, but they never did. She disappeared. And so she became kind of an iconic victim in the Troubles, this woman who disappeared and, you know, in vanishing like that, you had 10 kids who were orphaned.
Yeah. So I'll be honest, like you, we both grew up in the Boston area. So I had a lot of Irish friends. I had heard of the IRA. I had heard of the Good Friday Agreement. But I honestly did not know anything about the genesis of the conflict, how brutally violent it was. Can you give us a bit of a one-on-one on the Troubles? Like, who were the major players and how did it start and how bad did things get?
Yeah. You know, it's a tricky story, right? Because there's this question of where do you start?
Right.
My kind of somewhat humorous illustration of this is in one of the memoirs that Jerry Adams has published. He's got this, you know, he's got like a timeline, as you'll sometimes see in a memoir, and his timeline starts like almost 1,000 years ago.
Oh, good.
You got to go back to the beginning of the conflict. Basically, in the 1920s, you get the Irish War for Independence and the establishment of what we today call Ireland, which is the Republic of Ireland. And when that happened, the island of Ireland is partitioned, and there's six counties that remain under British dominion. They remain part of the United Kingdom. And for decades, there was a fair amount of discrimination against Catholics in Northern Ireland. Catholics were a minority in Northern Ireland. And there were these tensions that kind of simmered, and they finally came to a boil in the late 1960s. And so when we talk about the Troubles, it's a period of time really starting in 1968, 1969, in which you had a conflict, a violent conflict that lasted for 3 decades. And the players were the IRA and Irish Republican groups, which were paramilitary groups that wanted to drive the British out of Ireland once and for all. Loyalist paramilitary groups, and so these would be loyal to the British Crown, you know, primarily Protestant groups. The police, who were not really perceived necessarily as a neutral force, but were largely Protestant and also not always necessarily following the law themselves. And then the British Army, which comes in pretty early and is essentially dealing with kind of multi-vector insurgency. And then there are also a lot of excesses by the British Army. So you have all of these different parties really at war in the streets by 1971, and you know the violence kind of waxed and waned over the course of 3 decades, but it was really an undeclared war,
yeah.
Right until 1998 when the conflict ends.
And the reason I love the book so much is I learned so much about the Troubles, but I did it through the window of, you know, these real individuals who you track throughout, and their lives weave together in really unbelievable and fascinating ways. I don't want to give away anything because the ending is so fun. I want to let people find it themselves. But that's why the book is cool, because it's a great narrative, but you actually learn a ton about the Troubles. So fasting forward a little bit. So the Good Friday Agreement's negotiated in 1998, I believe. How much has Northern Ireland healed and integrated since that agreement?
Well, this is one of the things, as an American and even an Irish-American guy from Boston, that was really startling for me as I got into this. And it took me 4 years all in to do the, it started as a New Yorker article and then the book, and I made 7 trips over to Northern Ireland. And this was the steepest part of my learning curve early on, was that I think my ambient sense of the Good Friday Agreement in 98 had been, this is this landmark peace deal. They improbably end this long-running, grinding conflict in Europe. And I sort of thought everything was coming up roses. Mm-hmm. And you get over there and you realize the divisions are incredibly stark. You still have literally these huge walls, they call them peace walls, that separate different communities in Northern Ireland. There's amazing tension really everywhere between these communities. 90% of school children in Northern Ireland go to segregated schools, schools that are segregated by religion. So on the one hand, there's peace, and we should celebrate that. On the other hand, when you actually get over there and you get out into these communities, you realize it's an incredibly brittle, fragile peace. And that was part of what I was trying to do in the book is, you know, as you say, I sort of wanted to approach it not as a history book, but almost more like the way you would with a novel, in that I wanted to tell the story of a handful of people, and you would see the conflict through their eyes and their lives and see how they experienced it. But one thing that was true for all of those characters was that the past over there is not the past, right? It's the present. I mean, on the one hand, the conflict is over. On the other hand, everybody, every day is surrounded by the kind of resonance and the tensions and the trauma of that past in a very real way.
Yeah. I mean, tell me if this is a bad comparison, but as I read the book, I couldn't help but think about and compare Northern Ireland to, say, Gaza and the walls you talked about and the response to occupation there. And then it also made me think about how depressingly widespread sectarianism is and how, you know, I think, unfortunately, it's constantly talked about as a Sunni-Shia problem or a Muslim problem. And, you know, clearly there's a very different example in Christianity happening in Northern Ireland. Like, is there something universal in the story of Northern Ireland that came to you, or am I just...
No, I'm so glad to hear you say that, to be honest with you, because this was a thing it was a dilemma in the writing of the book, was that I kept feeling these echoes of other places and times, but I also felt as though I wanted to keep the aperture pretty tightly. I wanted to focus pretty tightly on this. I didn't want to keep breaking out and giving you comparative examples, but believe me, I mean, whether it's Gaza or... I spent a lot of time as I was working on the book talking with my colleague at The New Yorker, Philip Gurevich, who's written about Rwanda, mm-hmm. you know, another community in which you had people who were really at war, and then the conflict ends, but you still live across the street from the person you used to be at war with.
Right.
I mean, I also thought a lot about, you know, the book is very much about radicalization, and about the sort of the process through which a young person becomes kind of drunk on their own righteousness and gets absorbed into a cause and starts to do terrible things in the name of that cause. And so to the extent that you read the book and it feels like a specific story, but you can feel those echoes, I'm really glad, because I deliberately didn't keep breaking out in the book and saying, which is like this other conflict in this other place in this other time. But I certainly heard those harmonies along the way myself.
I mean, you mentioned Rwanda and living across the street from the person you were fighting. In Northern Ireland, I mean, so many of these IRA militants went on to be political leaders. I mean, you document in great detail in the book how Gerry Adams, who is, I guess, arguably the most famous IRA leader, was an operational leader. He was directing people to kill. Does it surprise you that he was ultimately welcomed into the Oval Office by Bill Clinton?
Yeah, this to me is one of the big ironies here, and it's one of the kind of inescapable complexities of this story, is that Gerry Adams is a guy who I think I pretty, you know, if Gerry Adams were were with us on this podcast today, he would tell us with a straight face that he was never in the IRA. Of course, nobody believes that. You know, he's always claimed that he was just part of the political wing, Sinn Féin. I think I document pretty substantially in the book that this is a guy who ordered war crimes. He was an operational figure in the IRA. Yet I would also tell you that I think it took real vision on the part of Bill Clinton to give him a visa and have him come to New York. And not only that, but there's a strange sense in which the BS story that Gerry Adams has always told about his own past in the IRA created a kind of political space in which, when the peace process starts up, people like George Mitchell and Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and others could negotiate with Gerry Adams, and they had a kind of rhetorical cover, right, in which they could say, well, I'm not negotiating with terrorists, I'm negotiating with Gerry Adams, and he was never in the IRA.
Right.
But it was understood that Adams could bring the IRA along. So I don't think there are easy answers here, and I certainly in the book didn't want to, you know, there aren't a lot of uncomplicated heroes. But I think one of the ironies with somebody like Adams is that you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there's no way to look at the evidence and not think that this is a guy who ordered war crimes and terrorist attacks, but also see that he ends up playing a really significant part in ending this conflict.
Yeah. I mean, it is also remarkable how many Americans openly supported the IRA. For example, Peter King, a Republican congressman from New York, who was on the Homeland Security Committee, he attended a pro-IRA rally in the early 80s, and he said, "We must pledge ourselves to support those brave men and women who, this very moment, are carrying forth the struggle against British imperialism in the streets of Belfast and Derry." End quote. Can you imagine if Rashida Tlaib, a congresswoman who's Palestinian, said that about Hamas? You know, it's like, I think clearly race and religion play a huge role in this, but like, how did it become acceptable for people in Long Island, for example, to support a terrorist group?
Yeah, I mean, some of this I think is just pure tribalism, right? And there's something like 30 million Irish Americans. There's way more Irish Americans than there are people in Ireland. Hmm. And there has long been a strain among Irish Americans of support for the IRA, even during the worst years of the Troubles. when you push into it, it gets a little weird, right? When I was growing up in Dorchester and Boston, in the bar down the street from my house, they used to pass the hat for the IRA. Hmm. When you go over to Northern Ireland, what's weird about this, right, is that it's kind of easy from the safe distance of Boston to give money to pay for bombs that are going to be planted in public places where there's no danger that your kids are going to like get caught because they happen to be at the shopping center on the wrong day. And there were other strange dissonances. I mean, one of the weird things about the 1980s is that a lot of the people raising money, and these would be Peter King's constituents in some instances, are like Irish American, wealthy Irish American guys in construction who are all Republicans, like conservative Republicans during the Reagan years. And in the book, I describe some of the meetings they would have with actual guys who worked for the Provisional IRA. And the Provisional IRA, they thought of themselves as socialist revolutionaries.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you get these weird moments where these guys actually start talking about what they want. And the American donors who are paying for the bombs say, wait a second, you're a socialist?
Yeah.
So I think sometimes they had less common ground than they thought they did. But it is a strange thing. And I'll tell you, even to this day, Gerry Adams, you know, the IRA now, the Sinn Féin is now a legitimate political party in Ireland. Gerry Adams, a famous kind of legitimate political figure at this point. But they still come over every year and have a big banquet at the Sheraton in New York. I've been to it. And they'll raise like $400,000 in an evening from Irish Americans who are eager to give them money.
Wow. You wrote this great piece for the New York Times recently about Brexit and how that agreement, or right at the moment, I guess, lack of an agreement, how the vote could reignite the troubles in Northern Ireland. Can you explain that? How is the Ireland-Northern Ireland border related to Brexit?
So during the Troubles, the border was a real hard border. It was a symbol of that conflict. You had sandbags. You had gun towers. You know, if you wanted to cross, you'd have to show ID. If there was a bus, you'd get British soldiers who would board the bus and search it. The border was a real symbol of the conflict. And if you think about it, if you were in the IRA, part of what you were fighting a war for was to erase that border. You wanted to reunify Ireland. And with the Good Friday Agreement, the border essentially disappears. You can now drive from the Republic of Ireland into Northern Ireland, and you cannot even know. The only way you know that you've crossed the border is that it changes from miles to kilometers. And, you know, if you're looking at your cell phone, the service changes that you get. Other than that, you wouldn't even know that you'd crossed the border. And that's been great for peace. It's been great for the economy. The insane thing about Brexit, I mean, one of the many insane things, but I think a contender for the most insane thing about Brexit, is that nobody, when they were designing the Leave campaign, thought about the idea that if the UK leaves the EU, then that border, which had essentially disappeared in recent decades, is going to have to be reinscribed, right? It will become the only land border between the UK and Europe. And that's been a big sticking point. I mean, you know, once they realized that you could jeopardize the peace in Northern Ireland, to say nothing of the economy, that became a big sticking point in the negotiations. And it's really one of the biggest stumbling blocks is, what do we do about this idea that if you are going to leave, how do we deal with the border? We have to have some kind of customs checks, but nobody wants to redraw that border. And Theresa May has no good answer for this.
Yeah.
Nobody in London has a good answer for this. And there's a very real prospect, depending on how Brexit goes. I mean, right now, as of the moment that you and I are having this conversation, it could be that the UK crashes out of the EU without any kind of deal about how they're going to do it on April 12th, if they can't postpone it or avoid it between now and then. And if that happens, they're going to have to redraw that border. And if they redraw the border, I think there's a very good chance that you're going to see a return of some violence, not the full-blown violence of the Troubles, but that those tensions that I was talking about are going to boil up once again.
Mm, great. Great work, everybody over in the UK.
Yeah, seriously.
My last question for you. How do you go about writing a book like this? I mean, you said you spent 4 years working on it, but you're able to, you know, write this narrative where we know what people are doing and actually thinking and saying in these moments over the course of so many years. Like, how do you get into all these characters' heads and a true accounting of their lives?
It's tricky. I mean, it takes a lot of legwork, particularly when you're writing about people who either won't talk to you or are dead. And I knew from the beginning that I wanted to have the story feel intimate so that you could really, really see these experiences through the eyes of the participants. But I honestly, I do in my day job, I do this kind of thing a fair amount. At The New Yorker, I do what we call write-arounds, where you don't have access to the central figure. And so a lot of it is just legwork. It's, you know, did they give interviews to other people? Are there unpublished letters that you can get? Are there friends of theirs who you can talk to and try and make it as vivid as possible? So the trick for me with this book was I wanted to write something that was both really well documented and entirely factual, but that in your hand would read pretty quickly. That
right.
you'd sort of it would be absorbing enough as a narrative that you didn't feel like you were having to slog through a lot of unnecessary exposition or an encyclopedic history. And, you know, I mean, that's the struggle with this kind of writing. But the useful thing in this case was the characters are so outsized. I mean, whether it's Dolores Price or Jerry Adams or this guy Brendan Hughes is another big figure in the book. I mean, these people had extraordinary, very dramatic lives. And they clashed with each other, and so there's a lot of conflict. And there's a way in which you can kind of tell the story of this history through the braided stories of these individuals. And, you know, I hope I pulled it off, but that was the ambition.
Yeah, I'd say you pulled it off. This is the Jerry Adams has a cold version of the book.
Exactly.
If you haven't read Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, everyone should check that out. The book is Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. I couldn't recommend it more. It's just a hell of a fun read, and I learned so much about Northern Ireland. Patrick, thank you so much for doing the show, and go Boston Celtics, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That's it for Pod Save the World. Thank you guys for listening. Rate and review us, and that's all we got. It's time to go home.
Let's do it.
Enough recording.
Yeah.
Bye.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.